You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandro Bates, your host, and this week I have a very special guest, as always. I have Rob Moore. Rob Moore is a long-term hobbyist and a professional vivarium specialist at the Seattle Spheres, and we've got a whole list of fun questions that we're going to cover. And Rob had actually reached out to me a few weeks ago. We started talking, and we hit it off. I was like, I got to get this guy on. He's working on some really cool projects. So we're going to get into that. We've got a lot of interesting topics, you know, kind of large-scale vivarium and aquarium builds. So it's going to be fun. But before we do that, of course, the usual stuff. I want to thank everybody for the nice 5-star reviews. Apple Podcasts, Spotify goes a long way. Spotify is over like 151 five stars. So thank you everyone for that. Again, always appreciate that. And if you're looking to support the show, some great ways to do so, of course, consider becoming a patron. That'll get you a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode if you become a $5 tier patron. And you can also check out the link tree for all the show notes. That'll take you to the merch store. It'll take you to the In Situ Ecosystems affiliate link. Now, if you buy a tank there, you get a discount. And, all the fun stuff. Like I said, check out the link tree in the show notes. And of course, check out this week's sponsor in the show notes as well. So I'm ready to go full steam ahead. Rob, how are you tonight? What's going on?
Hey, Dan. Yeah, doing great. Home from work and really excited to talk frogs and fish and whatever else we can talk about.
Yeah, East Coast versus West Coast. And you and I actually, we kind of started off our discussion a few weeks ago. We were talking about fish and we were kind of comparing East Coast and West Coast, and we're both kind of getting into fishing season, but maybe we'll cover that a little bit at the end. So I've kind of gone halfway into like a, all these fishing people are following me now, which is cool, but
oh yeah,
I guess that's, that could be my side hustle. So you've got a very, very interesting resume here. So you've got a PhD in animal behavior. You've been in the frog and aquarium hobby. You've worked professionally and scientifically with fish. You work for the Seattle Spheres, which is sort of like a, I'm kind of struggling to describe how big it is here, but basically like a massive vivarium. So we'll kind of discuss what goes into doing that professionally. But I was wondering if you could maybe begin at the beginning and kind of walk us up through your career. Maybe tell us how you started out. What were your earliest influences? What got you into frogs? What got you into, you know, your current line of work now? How did you end up where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my story is very similar to a lot of the other people we've had on the show. I grew up in Southern California, kind of along the coast. And really my earliest memories are just being outside in the chaparral, catching lizards, snakes. I mean, we were literally backed up to the Santa Monica Mountains and the wilderness there where you could find horned lizards and king snakes, rattlesnakes. And going back, that was just like my passion. Anything I could get my hands on, creepy crawly, I wanted. And that was actually instilled in me by my dad. He was also very much the same way when he was a kid. So it's kind of like a passed down generationally thing. I'm trying to get my son involved in it too. But yeah, I was out in the, back of the house, catching lizards, going to the tide pools, looking for, seashells and octopuses and anything else I could wrangle. And it's kind of as early as I can remember, I was keeping things in glass boxes. So I had aquariums in my bedroom. Pretty much the rule of the house was if I could catch it, I could keep it. So it wasn't really till later in life that I got into exotics, but if it was a native species that I could find a way to bring into my room, I would do it. And so that kind of was a ever-growing passion. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have a family that would travel occasionally. So we would go to these tropical destinations like the Caribbean or Hawaii or someplace like that. And I would get to, chase anole lizards and geckos and things like that. And it was just, that was like my dreamland. And I can remember when I was about 10 years old, we went to Costa Rica. And that was the first time I saw Ufaga pomelio, your classic blue jeans in the wild. And I was just like absolutely hooked. And so it was kind of from that point forward that I was really into tropical frogs, really. I always and still have a love for snakes and lizards, but I always hated getting bitten by them. So that was one nice thing about frogs is you could keep them. They were beautiful. They have interesting behaviors and they don't really bite. So that was kind of the wimp side of me coming out early. So I definitely had some chameleons and rainbow boas and other things throughout the years, but it was around, I think, as soon as I got a driver's license, I went out to a reptile shop that's unfortunately no longer there anymore in the valley outside of LA, and they had some tinctorius. At the time, they were called blue sipple weenies, I believe, and the shop owner built me out this little 10-gallon vivarium, I'll say in quotes, because it was not much to speak of by today's standards, but it was like, you know, a cutting of pothos, maybe like up some pillow moss, like a sad excuse for a bromeliad and like a water dish. And then this blue tink. And I just thought it was like the best thing ever. Started culturing fruit flies in my bathroom to, you know, varied levels of successes with my homemade mashed potato media. And it was kind of, that was kind of the gateway, and it just kind of spiraled. So when I was, before I even turned 18, I decided to go to the University of Washington undergrad. So I moved from California to Seattle. The opportunity for lizards and snakes outside is much, much more limited. We do have a decent diversity of salamanders and things here, but we have garter snakes, and that's like for 2 months out of the year. So my interest in tropicals was still there. And so I actually wound up buying some leucomelas at one of like the local reptile shows from one of the big name vendors who will not be named. And so like throughout college, I was keeping these leucs in my sort of like college dormitory housing. But then, you know, I'd be going home or I'd be trying to travel on spring break. And it just became this kind of hassle of who's going to take care of these frogs when I'm out and about. And it was actually during that same time where I was, you know, taking every penny I could possibly scrape together to try to buy a plane ticket back to Costa Rica or back to someplace tropical to, you know, really try to connect with these things in the wild and see how they live. And I actually made a really close friend in Costa Rica he was a tour guide. So he'd basically say like, hey, you can get down here and then you can just tag along on these like group tours and like stay in the room with me and like basically pay nothing. So I got, you know, this really cool kind of like a travel experience throughout Central America where I got to see, you know, different critters in the jungles, but then also scratch my other itch, which was tropical reefs. So I got pretty into diving, you know, looking for you know, all the sea creatures I could possibly find, which goes, you know, into the fish keeping world where I've had reef tanks and freshwater aquarium. So yeah, it's kind of a lifelong thing. You know, it's just one thing builds on another thing, and it's, you know, you just wind up going down these rabbit holes of passion, which is, you know, pretty exciting and fun. And that kind of kept going. I stayed in Seattle, and actually as an undergrad, I had the opportunity to work in a research lab studying these kind of interesting fish in the toadfish family that are native along the west coast of the U.S. They're called plainfin midshipman fish, and they're a sound-producing fish that have really interesting sort of mating behaviors and that they act kind of like birds where like males will set up territories and then produce sound to attract females. And it was during this time working in this lab that I was offered the opportunity to pursue a graduate degree. So I wound up joining this lab as a PhD student. And in those dark days in the laboratory studying these fish, I was that kind of itch for the tropics kept coming back. And that's when I started volunteering at the University of Washington greenhouse. And I was doing that basically in exchange for tropical plant cuttings so that I could build more frog tanks. So it's all this like circuitous sort of roundabout pathway to, you know, working with these animals I loved. I enjoyed working in research and in the lab, but I always had a dream of working with frogs. I see somebody like Justin Yeager or Evan Twomey or like any of these like PhDs who get to study like poison frogs in the wild. And it was like, that was the fantasy. But that didn't materialize for me. Also, I mean, at that point, I met my girlfriend, now wife. And so the idea of being stuck in the field halfway around the world was becoming less and less realistic as, you know, life gets in the way. So it became, you know, this opportunity to have these frogs at home as a hobby and kind of keep the fish and the professional side of things separate. So that's kind of where the division happened, I guess, where my kind of path diverged from, you know, okay, I'm not going to do frogs in a laboratory, like research setting. I'll just do that as a hobby, which is great. I can still enjoy them for what they are in that sense. And then fish kind of became like my profession at that time, whether I knew that was where I was going to end up or not. And it was actually through the frog hobby where I met the people who were involved in creating the Spheres project. So when I was volunteering at the University of Washington Greenhouse, they started donating plants for this Spheres endeavor, which was still in the design and construction phase. I had no idea what it was. It was kind of secret at the time. But I started hearing more about it, and I started to meet the people involved. And the more and more I learned that they were essentially building these three bubbles in the middle of downtown Seattle that were going to house tens of thousands of tropical plants, I knew it was something I wanted to be a part of. So after grad school finished, the idea of becoming a professor was feeling less and less like something I wanted to do. And I just happened to be kind of in the right place, right time through this frog tropical plant hobby. And I met the people at a local vivarium society meeting. And they basically offered me a job to be an ambassador or like a docent essentially for the Spheres building. And this was before it even opened. So nobody really knew what that was going to look like. And after about a year in that role, I transitioned to the horticulture program and started maintaining all of the planted aquariums and terrariums that we have in the Spheres. So very long-winded answer, which maybe made no sense, but that is more or less how I got to where I am today.
All right, a few follow-up questions. Number one,
yeah.
Actually, I have more than a few. So for anybody who's not familiar, like, you know, bozos like me who live out on the East Coast, the Spheres is, if you were to just kind of describe it, like, what is it? Is it an exhibit that people walk through? Is it a shared space? Is it, like, how would you describe it for someone who's never heard of it or seen it before?
So it was designed as an alternative workspace in a place that people could connect with nature. So it's not really, if you go look up the Seattle Spheres, you'll quickly learn who it belongs to. But essentially, it's meant as an alternative workspace for employees to come and really immerse themselves in nature. So the building is four floors, essentially. The first floor has a large 600-gallon aquarium and then an immersive forest path, which is all plants, tropical plants from Central and South America, primarily. And then the second floor is plants from the Eastern Hemisphere, so a lot of tropical Asia and Africa represented there. And then as you move up towards the third and the fourth floor, it's more open seating and kind of open meeting areas where people can connect, bring their laptops, work sort of surrounded by tropical plants. And also throughout the space, we have a 65-foot tall living wall that is kind of the center of the building that you can pretty much see from every angle, as well as several other wall-hung terrariums, other living walls, basically surrounded by plants at all angles. And it's it was designed to be comfortable for people and for plants. So we are roughly at 60% humidity throughout the day and roughly 72 degrees. So it's not hot and muggy like a typical tropical greenhouse. It's kind of fringe, you know, we're working towards that like subtropical feeling. So on a cold day, it feels fantastic. And on a hot day, it feels pretty good too, because, you know, we're pumping a ton of air. We're constantly turning the air over in the building for circulation for the plant health. So it's kind of like the best possible air quality you could imagine any time of year, and kind of like ideal conditions for human comfort as well as plant comfort. So it's kind of neat.
Now, do people have workstations? Like, again, I'm trying to think of this, like, are there cubicles, are there desks, are there offices?
Nope. No, it's all just open seating. Nothing is reservable. It's just kind of show up and find an open table, hang out, bring your lunch, bring some guests. A lot of people do use it as a place to show off to friends and families. And we also do open up twice a month fully for the public by free reservation. So anybody who's in the Seattle area, first or third Saturdays of every month, we open up for free visitation. You can just make a reservation at seattlespheres.com, and it's totally free.
And the environmental conditions, you mentioned airflow, which is, of course, very, very important, and that's something that is important with our home vivariums as well on a smaller scale. But what about lighting and watering? How do you accomplish that?
Absolutely, yeah. So the building is glass, so it's basically three bubbles, I guess you call it. That's why it's called the spheres. It's three kind of interconnected spheres. When you're inside, it just feels like one big space. You can't really tell that it's three. But so we are getting some levels of natural sunlight. That being said, we are also in Seattle, which is not necessarily the sunniest place on earth. So we have an array of LED lighting, full spectrum for plant growth and for plant health. It's on a system basically to hit daily light intensity targets. So we can program the system to say, like, hey, this is the target. So depending on how much sunlight we get throughout the day, either turn up or turn down the LEDs throughout the day. So it's a pretty smart building in that sense, so that the lights, you know, are running to match what the plants need. And we also have lighting along the floor plates to help illuminate areas of the living wall. So we have suspended lights above the kind of two conservatory-type areas, and then lighting throughout to help supplement the living wall as well. And then in terms of watering, we have misting system throughout the building that are also on sensors. So if the humidity drops, then the misting system will turn on for ambient humidity. And then all of the watering is done by hand. We have a team of six full-time horticulturists who are there 365 days a year, hand water all of the garden beds. And the living wall is on a different system, which I can talk more about. But that's kind of an auto watering kind of pseudo-hydroponic system.
Yeah, and the lighting, do the lights go off at night? Do they stay on? How does that affect the plant dynamic in there?
Yeah, they do go off. We're on roughly 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., so we're on about a 12-hour light cycle. You know, there are instances where if there's like a special after-hours event, they might stay on till 9, but generally, yeah, we're on a 12-hour year-round light cycle for the artificial lighting. And then, of course, in Seattle, we get pretty long summer days, so the plants could be getting, you know, 16, 17 hours of light through the glass naturally in the summertime. So we do see seasonal changes in plant growth due to just extrinsic, you know, Seattle factors.
What sort of substrates? I mean, I want to discuss the living wall in a little bit more detail, because I know you mentioned that's kind of a hydroponic, or tending towards more hydroponic. But for the plants, I mean, obviously this is in the middle of Seattle, so it's going to have some sort of a substrate or soil or something. How does that work?
Yeah. So the beds are all pretty deep. So they have a huge amount of drainage layer. So like sand and aggregate below the soil level. And then in terms of like the actual soil mix, like these plants are planted in the ground in the beds. So they're not potted plants. So we have various different sort of media mixes of aggregate and sort of classic soils that, you know, bark and things that are mixed into, I can't really tell you what the exact, you know, measurements are, but, you know, not super dissimilar from like an ABG style mix in terms of most of our in-ground plantings. And then, of course, we also have, we have some large trees in the space with that are covered in epiphytes. We have a stream that has, you know, kind of rheophytic plants growing and rocks covered in moss and other, you know, the building's been open for about 6 years now. And over time, the amount of just like colonization from, you know, things throwing seeds and spores popping up, ferns everywhere and mosses spreading. I mean, it's, the building's kind of coming alive, which is pretty awesome to see, you know, something that only time can do. So it's ever changing, you know, it's meant to be a permanent, like the plants we put in there are not meant to be rotational for the most part. So what we bring in, we intend to stay there like a botanic garden. And of course we, you know, we do have things that get out competed or things that maybe are struggling for whatever reason. We do rotate them out if needed, but the consensus, this is meant to be a permanent garden.
What level of landscape architecture went into this? Because I'm assuming there's going to be focal points that are going to want to be displayed, and there might be something that's particularly eye-catching. Does that factor into this as well, or was it just sort of like, I mean, basically what I'm asking is, was there like a 5-year or 10-year plan where people would say, all right, well, in 10 years, this tree will become a focal point, or these epiphytes will become a focal point in 3 years? Is, how does that work out?
So without, again, going into too much detail, the initial ask was for the building to look like year 5 on day 1. So meaning that when the sphere is first opened to the public, they wanted it to look like a mature garden. And very much it did. They have we have offsite greenhouses where we were pre-growing the plants in terms of, so for years. So some of which we grew from seed, some were from cutting, some were purchased and then grown. Plants were donated from various botanical gardens, institutions. As I mentioned, University of Washington was a big donor of tropical plant material. And in terms of the trees, those are kind of the biggest hurdle. Sort of the centerpiece, or like almost like the mascot, I would say, of the building is this 65, or it's about 55 feet tall, Ficus rubiginosa. It's a, they call it the rusty fig. It's, we call her Ruby. It's a tree native to Australia, but it was grown in a tree nursery in California. And there's videos online people can look up, but it's, it was this whole journey from the spheres needed to be completed and the HVAC had to be ready, and basically everything had to be ready for this tree to go in because it had to survive once it was planted in place. So we had to basically have the, and this was before my time, so I can take zero credit for this process, but basically the tree was brought in from California. They had to deconstruct about an 18-foot section in the ceiling of the, of one of the spheres. And they used a giant crane to kind of like thread the needle of this tree through the hole in the roof and get it planted in the spheres, and then reassemble the roof and put the glass back on. So that tree is takes a lot of care, a lot of maintenance. We do have arborists who come in about twice a year just to work on her and make sure she's staying healthy and pruned to a nice full shape to stay within the spheres, because if we didn't take action, she would try to grow outside the building. So those are things we have to consider that do require much upkeep.
I'm just visualizing that now, this tree on a crane being lowered.
Yeah, there's video. Seriously, people should check it out. You could Google like spheres Ruby, R-U-B-I, transport. And yeah, there's like time lapses of it and stuff. It's pretty cool.
It's just such an, I mean, the nearest thing that I can think of is the Christmas tree in Manhattan, Rockefeller Center. And I'm I'm just picturing someone lowering it through. Like, that's amazing. The level of sophistication that this, wow, that's incredible. How long did it take from the physical building being constructed to it being stocked and ready to be occupied by people? How many
years, months? Yeah, how long did that take?
I believe it was about 5 years, kind of from like when they started construction, or when the project was proposed to construction, to getting greenhouse space, to procuring plants, to doors opening. It was about 5 years. So it was actually pretty quick turnaround. I think the actual construction took about 2.5 years, if I'm not mistaken. But the whole sort of design phase and to delivery was about 5 years.
Now, the living wall. So that's interesting, because I've seen quite a few throughout my travels here and there. And I was at a dance competition, and I was just kind of, you know, sitting out in the lobby, like with nothing better to do. And I'm staring at this living wall. I'm like really like looking at this thing, trying to figure out how it works. And I mean, from what I could gather, it looks like it's pretty much hydroponic, but I mean, you're the expert. How do you maintain something, especially something that's that high up? Do you have water that recirculates, or how has that stay watered and fed and aerated enough that it can continue to grow?
Yeah, absolutely. So the technology was developed by the head of our program, and it's really innovative. He experimented with a number of different textiles, so synthetic fabrics to use as wicking material. So similar to like Hygrolon or something that people would use in a vivarium. And basically the wall is constructed of basically like pockets. So like over the door shoe holders, you can kind of imagine, where there's kind of like the individual like pockets for your shoes, basically like that, made out of like synthetic water wicking, but yet breathable fabric, which you can put plants in. And then essentially the way it works is that at the top of the wall, you have a header, which releases water, and you can put that on whatever cycle you want. We have it going off, you know, on a cadence of, I don't even know, like for a minute every half hour or something, let's just say, for rough numbers. And so then it basically acts like a very slow drip system or waterfall, where the water is basically just slowly cascading down into the very bottom, where there's a trough gutter, essentially, from which it goes down two stories into the parking garage, into a room where we have a giant reservoir. And in that reservoir, we are actively measuring EC, so electrical conductivity, so basically the salt content in the water, which is from our fertilizers, and the pH. So it's not dissimilar to what people would have on an aquarium with auto dosing. So we're basically just have set points for the fertilizer targets we're trying to hit and the pH we're trying to maintain, and it will auto dose to keep the numbers in check. And that's on a continuous cycle. And then the water is pumped back up to the top, and it just recirculates. And every once in a while, we'll do a flush, you know, to make sure that we're keeping our system clean. But yeah, it's basically just, it's not fully hydroponic in that those plant pockets do have a little bit of residual soil or aggregate on the roots of the plants. But in some cases, we do just put them just bare root into the pockets as well.
Which species of plants do you have at that facility? And then maybe kind of tell us which species would make for good candidates in general for a living wall.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I should say that one large system it's about 1,000-gallon reservoir, actually feeds and waters four permanently installed living walls in the spheres, the biggest of which I mentioned is about 65 feet tall and about 55 feet wide. So roughly there's about 4,000 square feet of living wall in the space with over 25,000 individual plant pockets. So, and amongst those 25,000 individual plants, we have roughly 200 species. So a lot of them are similar to what people would use in vivariums. So a lot of aroids, a lot of philodendrons and anthuriums. We do use various ferns, a lot of calatheas and geopardia type plants. And, you know, as I mentioned, we have lighting installed in the floor plates to help illuminate the wall, but nothing beats natural sunlight, and that's just, there's just no going around that. So we can really play around more with diversity as we go higher up the wall, where we're getting more natural sunlight into the building. in there we can do, you know, more orchids, more brightly colored flowering plants and gesneriads. But I mean, honestly, if we have something new, we just experiment. We play around with, you know, all different things and see what will work. But yeah, aeroids are definitely an easy favorite. They do well in pretty much all lighting conditions, and they're not super picky when it comes to, you know, food, and a lot of them grow like weeds. And then I think maybe follow-up question that I didn't get to was how we maintain it on such a large scale. So basically, we have like a living like a window washing basket, essentially. So above the wall, two kind of arms stick out with hoists that drop down and connect to a large basket. So two of our team members will harness up and work basically one vertical section of the wall in roughly 10 to 12 foot wide increments. So we basically take some extra plant material, a big trash can, and some scissors, start at the top of one section of wall, and just work our way all the way down to the bottom. It takes about 2 hours to do that like 10 foot wide section. And we do that 3 mornings a week. So 5:30, 6 a.m., we get up there, spend about 2-3 hours pruning, taking yellow leaves, popping in new plants as needed, taking out plants that are too big. And yeah, it's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. It's just a never ending job.
Do you have plants on reserve in the event that something doesn't do well or dies off? Do you have a backup stockpile or anything like that?
We do. Yeah. So we have a whole backup greenhouse facility. It's a rather large space. It's outside of Seattle city limits, but we have a whole greenhouse team and staff maintaining a permanent collection of plants, as well as producing production plants for the living wall and for use in the spheres, as well as in other office buildings that we maintain. So about once a week, we will take sort of a cargo van out there and stock up with everybody's kind of requests and needs for the week. And we have a very small, like little greenhouse in our shared office where we can just like temporarily store the week's plants that we need to use. And then similarly, if there's plants that we want to send back to our greenhouse team to, you know, rehab, we'll send those back on the same day.
Water quality. That's what I'm kind of curious about next. And you have a background with aquatics, saltwater, et cetera. And we talked about that when we were kind of covering your background as well, your research. What role does water quality play with something like this? Because I've heard different things from different people about certain substrates maintaining too much salts and water not being, I think when I was talking to Drew from Carnivoro, he was talking to me about like tap water being too harsh for carnivorous plants. With something like this, what are the ideal water parameters and how do you maintain them?
All I can say is that there is no better place that I know of than Seattle for water quality out of the tap. So we have out of our taps in Seattle City Water about 30 TDS, and that's about as close to RO water as you could possibly want. So, you know, if we were doing this in New York, we would have to be using RO water. But because our water is so pure out of the tap, we really don't need to do anything to it. We do have some large carbon block filters in line with some of our hoses that I use for like aquariums and stuff so that I don't have to dechlorinate. But for the living walls and for watering the garden beds, we are literally using garden hose water straight out of the tap. And that's just a product of where we are. And just we're lucky. That's really what it comes down to. But yeah, like Drew, for example, yeah, carnivorous plants, super, super sensitive. So anything more than what we're working with out of the tap, we would have to be using RO water, RODI. And we do have... our greenhouse facility is on well water, which is much different quality. So we do have to use a lot of RO out there and mix that in to our supply, especially when it comes to fertilizing, because, you know, generally you're just measuring TDS or EC, which are basically different words for the same thing, just the salt content in your water. So if you're starting off with, if you have a target of 500 ppm of nitrogen or whatever nutrient you're trying to add, but you're starting off with 200, then how much do you want to add? So it's always good to start as close to zero as possible. So as close to pure water, neutral pH. And it just so happens that we live in the best place for that.
So, I mean, do you have any issues with hard water stains or spotting or any of that at all?
Close to zero. We are maintaining our, terrariums and aquariums on a daily basis. So that, I think we'll talk about this more as we go on as well, but this isn't, something that like a home terrarium where like, oh, maybe I'll get a little lax and forget to clean the glass for a few weeks here and there. These are getting daily attention. So things like hard water buildup aren't really as big of a concern, but I've used RO systems in the past at home and then switched to tap water and noticed absolutely zero difference in glass buildup.
I've noticed a difference depending on whether it's an aquarium or whether it's a front opening terrarium, but that's probably just unique to my little corner of the world here. And I've gone on about how poor our water, our water quality here is. If you drank it without going through our municipality, you'd probably end up getting cancer because it's polluted by the Navy's kind of covering the cleanup. But there was a news article the other day about a couple of drums being found buried in concrete with some stuff in it that shouldn't have been there. So I'm always envious of people that have quality water. Because we don't have it here on the island.
Yeah, there's a we have team members in other parts of the country and they are definitely not as lucky. There's talk of expansion into, Virginia, and it's basically like liquid rock coming out of the faucet. So it's a luxury, especially for the aquariums, which is sort of my primary area of focus. So keeping softwater fishes, like most of the fish from the Amazon, most Southeast Asian fish, it's kind of a dream. It makes my job a lot easier. And I have to basically, I'm remineralizing because, we don't have enough calcium in the water. So it's a good problem to have.
Where does Seattle's water come from? Well, what's the source?
I believe the Cascade Mountains. So Seattle is very close to two mountain ranges, really, but the Cascade Mountains kind of break the state in half. And you drive like 30, 40 minutes east of the city and you're in the mountains. And, a lot of those peaks are covered in snow year round.
Yeah, we're on aquifers here. I mean, if anybody's not familiar, that's... You're going to like the lowest level of groundwater below layers and layers of sand because the uppermost layers were just so polluted. But like New York City, they have reservoirs further upstate, further north. So New York City water is different from Long Island water. So we're all on our own wells here and you're kind of at the mercy of whatever's down there.
Yeah, same with actually where I live. I live across the Puget Sound to the west and we're on an aquifer here at our house too. And our water, it's actually it's pretty good. It's not even as good as Seattle city water, but it's like 60 TDS out of the tap and you could definitely drink it straight from the spigot, which is pretty nice. But I have friends who live 2 miles north and they have to use softeners because their water's so hard. So it's really kind of a geographical and you can find these little pockets of, limestone that are leaching into your water and really messing up the chemistry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't really think about, I always think about the pollutants, but I never really thought about the geology aspect of it. You ever see an artesian well, like a legit artesian well?
I think that's what they have in Rome, right?
We actually have them here on some of the barrier islands that are south of where I live. There really isn't any, fresh, they can't do an aquifer because there's ocean on within a few hundred feet of the house. So they actually drill into artesian wells. Which is pretty cool. I mean, everybody who's listening, it's kind of like, just to put it simply, it's like a pocket of fresh water between two layers of rock or stiff substrate, and that pressure brings it to the surface. And it's pretty cool. Like, I've seen a couple of houses on them, and, again, I don't know if I'd drink it, but the whole premise is just, I don't know, it's just so cool, just seeing water come up from the ground by itself in the simplest way possible.
Yeah. That's super cool. Yeah, I could be wrong, but I could swear there was like an old school frogger who's not around anymore that was like in Pennsylvania And he would drive to his like old town to get water from his artesian well because he swore that that was like best for his tadpoles. But I could be confused. It could have just been regular well water.
Yeah, people are superstitious about New York water too, making the best bagels, and like there's stories of people like running New York water down to like Florida and whatnot to make bagels. I don't know. All right, let's get
my father-in-law swears by it, so he's okay. On your side for that argument.
All right, so he agrees with me then. It's not just a myth, but bagels aside though, I wanted to ask you about the entry point, and we kind of talked about frogs as sort of being this default entry point into this world for you. And there are people that come into this from the reptile world. There are people that come into it from the plant world, people who come into it from the aquatics world. And you kind of came in with a formal education in fish and aquatic organism management, I guess, if we could put it that way. How has that changed, or how has that affected your perspective with regards to keeping frogs?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I feel like in a lot of ways, I kind of had so many influences into my frog keeping. So, you know, it started with reptiles, but at the same time, I was keeping reef tanks and freshwater tanks. So I don't know if I have a good answer. This is the unfortunate response. You know, keeping fish in a laboratory is not the same as keeping fish in your home, and it's definitely not the same as keeping fish on display for, you know, people to see. And it's also not the same as a public aquarium. So it's kind of this weird, I have sort of differing views on it, I guess, depending on where, you know, things are going to be. So I, you know, like I said, I've spent a good amount of time traveling in the jungles, in tropical places, and always kind of try to do my best to replicate that as much as I can. You know, maybe this is a tangent that's not relevant to anything, but I think about, you know, the frogs that I've kept over the years, and then, you know, people will tell you like, what's the best way to breed them? Like what, this is, you know, this is what I've researched online about it. And then the people who have success, and then you go and you see it in nature and it's totally different. So for example, I had, Amiriga pongoensis, in captivity for a while. These were frogs that were brought in through understory years ago in very small numbers. And I think there was only like two people who figured out how to breed them, in the US at the time. And the one guy who I got mine from basically was like, oh yeah, I live in the mountains and I keep it cold. I open the window in the wintertime. I give them like 15, 20 degree temperature drops. And yeah, they breed like rabbits. It's like easy. I was like, okay, that's, you know, something to try to replicate, you know. And then, you know, fast forward to March 2020, literally hours away from being trapped in Peru before COVID shut down. I was in Peru on a tour with Understory, seeing pongoensis in the wild. And it's maybe one of the hottest jungles I've ever been in. Not cold at all. Dry as a bone, 15 feet away from rushing rapids. So nothing like a cold cloud forest environment like you might imagine, like dry, lowland, tropical, hot forest. And apparently they're breeding there too. So, you know, you try to find these anecdotes and these stories, and one person's success is, you know, another person's failure. And maybe it's, you know, going back to water quality. And, you know, it's just like there's so many of these variables that we try to control that are, you know, sometimes on a case-by-case basis. And so I think in terms of my keeping, I try to steer away from the dogmas as much as possible and try to, you know, use what works best for me and know that that might not be what works best for somebody else. And so it's kind of fun to experiment, you know. It's like you want to give these animals the best possible chance they have to survive, not only survive, but thrive, and also show you the full array of natural behaviors, which make them interesting. So I think just kind of my background and, you know, I'd say as a kid, it's keeping animals, I did a really bad job. You know, this was pre-internet. The books, the resources were terrible. And now we have, you know, the internet, you have Dendroboard. Before that, you had, you know, listservs and people communicating with each other. And I mean, it's such a different world now for keeping keeping these things in boxes. And, you know, supplementation has come so far, you know, and that makes a huge difference. It's kind of an instant cheat code for breeding a lot of frogs. I mean, I don't remember the last time I heard about somebody rearing tadpoles with SLS, and that's probably because of supplementation. So, you know, there's just something to be said about trial and error, learning from people, finding a mentor, somebody local you can connect with, who can give you some insights, but then, you know, just doing your best and trying something, you know, that's not completely formulaic, maybe going a little bit outside the box. And, you know, you might end up with something, you know, some sort of success that hasn't been found before.
I just want to back up a minute here. So wait, so you got trapped in Peru in March of 2020?
I was hours away from being grounded. Yeah, so it was crazy. It was, and my wife was pregnant with our first child. And I flew to Peru, to Tarapoto, I think March 10th, 2020. And Seattle was like ground zero for COVID. So like the first cases were here, where like it popped up in a nursing home just north of the city. And so like it was on the radar here, but I flew to Peru, didn't really think much of it. Nobody down there said a thing. I think that was Sunday. Then like Tuesday on the news, it was like, you know, like, oh, the world is experiencing this new pandemic perhaps. And then by like that Friday, it was like every day was just like drastic steps forward. And they were like, I think it was like 5 days into the trip, they're like, yeah, we're shutting down the borders tomorrow, sort of thing. It was like, I had to change my flight to try to get out. And my original flight out of the country was grounded by less than an hour. And I would have been stuck there for weeks waiting for a repatriation flight. And it actually happened to a friend of mine who was in Iquitos at that time. So yeah, it was crazy. It was insane to see how fast it escalated there. But I got to see a lot of really cool frogs before, before I left.
Yeah. 2020 was a game changer. And it's right after, I remember watching the whole COVID thing unfold, and it happened in Seattle, and it was like, okay, well, you know, it's similar stuff like this has happened before. It wasn't, you know, it was contained. It wasn't a huge deal. And then it happened here in New York. It started up in, I don't know, names, but it started in a county north of New York City. And then it kind of, it hit here like crazy. And we were not happy. We're not happy with Seattle, but, yeah, it got really bad. And that whole, like, I heard about, I mean, again, not to segue too off topic into the fishing thing, but I was listening to a podcast about, you know, just fishing. And there was this captain down in the Bahamas, and he got into, it had nothing to do with him per se. Apparently, you know, legal system's a little out of control down there. And he ended up getting, locked up in a Bahamian prison. Like, and he was set to go for a court hearing to be released, and then COVID hit, and he ended up getting stuck in that prison for like 3 or 4 months or something like that during the height of COVID. So it was just, I mean, it was bad in the U.S., but I can only imagine people outside of the U.S. trying to get back in.
Yeah, and big shout out to Mark Pepper from Understory, because he called like the day before things were really starting to get wild, and he was like, you know, if you do get stuck, you're welcome to stay at the house, and you know, make sure you're safe. So thanks to Mark for looking out for us down there. Cause, I could have, if we got trapped there, being at the Understory house in Tarapoto, it's not the worst place in the world to be. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. I can imagine that probably would be the perfect place to hide out for the next 2 years. Yeah. A lot went on in 2020, but that's interesting. And with regards to what you've taken from the wild, how does what you see in the wild in your free time influence how, like, what you do professionally? I mean, I kind of asked a similar question, but when you're in a wild environment and things just kind of go unsupervised by adult hands, or by human hands, I should say, as opposed to something that's going to take a lot of cultivation to make it, you know, like were there any takeaways with regards to the plants from seeing wild plants to maintaining captive plants in a situation like this?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I'll say, especially in regards to the spheres, is we are very far from nature, and that we are extremely manicured. We do not look at yellow leaves kindly. So anytime we see a yellowing or brown leaf, like, it's removed instantly. And nature is so imperfect, which is, you know, what makes it great. So there's that sort of dichotomy there where it's, we're trying to create these naturalistic displays and experiences, but kind of at like a supernatural level where everything is like perfect all the time. So that, it's kind of this weird thing in my brain where it's like, I see a yellow leaf in somebody's Instagram post and they're like, I start like spazzing out a little bit just because it's been like trained into me. That's like not okay in like a terrarium. But of course, nature is full of yellow leaves and holes and, you know, 18 inches deep of leaf litter is, you know, what these frogs probably want most. So yeah, things, you know, you see things like that and sometimes you have to separate what is natural versus like what actually is nice to look at in your home or in a display setting. So that's one thing to take away. Another thing is just, yeah, if, you know, if you go to a cloud forest, like one of the spots in Peru, the locale for like Highland Variabilis and Amirga, what are they? But one of the sort of higher elevation at sort of the top of the mountain there as you kind of cross, you know, I know Josh Allen has talked a lot about this on your podcast before, but you get sort of to the top of the Cordillera there between over the mountains from Tarapoto going down towards Yurimaguas and Pongo de Cainarachi. And that peak of that mountain range is just the most stunning cloud forest you could possibly imagine. And it's kind of like everybody's like quintessential, you know, moss laden bromeliads everywhere, like filmy ferns. It's just like, it's heaven, you know, and the frogs are plentiful. It's kind of a dream. So seeing places like that and then going to the spheres and be like, yeah, I want to throw like way more moss in here and just let it go wild and way more, you know, epiphytes, small and large, and just kind of like let them take over. And I think over time, you know, some of these things just naturally will do that. So kind of picking and choosing where that's okay and knowing that like, okay, that rock or that stump or that, you know, lower half of that tree might get swallowed, but that is actually kind of nature at its best, in my opinion. So things like that, you know, some of those takeaways. But unfortunately, yeah, we do not have a leaf litter present in the spheres. We are very manicured. So it's not really a, as much as I want it to be a walk-in frog tank, it's very much still an office building, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting how people like, I think about how different people's perspectives on life affect decisions, especially with regard to what people find aesthetically pleasing. And I mean, to people like us, having this thick layer of leaf litter is just like, you know, like the chef's kiss. It's like perfect, you know, like you look at it, you're like, ah, this is the way it's supposed to be. But whenever you go to an arboretum or something like that, there's like three or four arboretums out here by me, and I never see leaf litter on the floor of any of the greenhouses or anything like that. So it's like, you want to celebrate the life part of it, but not the death and decomposition. I don't know.
Yeah. For us, a lot of it comes down to like pest issues. You know, the more like leaf litter and decaying matter you have, the more chances you have to like harbor things you don't want, you know? So unfortunately, you know, pests are a real concern for every garden everywhere, especially one where we can't, you know, be spraying pesticides. So we're using a lot of beneficial insects to try to, you know, maintain, keep our pest populations down. So the less surface area we have for things like, you know, scale and mealybug and aphids to reproduce, the better. So that's part of it. I think that's also a reason a lot of conservatories and stuff also probably clean up their leaf litter.
That was going to be my next question, actually, was pest control. And not even so much pest control, but invasive plants. I mean, what do you do if you walk into work one day and there's a dandelion coming up out of the ground staring at you?
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had that. It's more like greenhouse pests. So like oxalis or like some of these like tagalong ferns that will show up on like orchid mounts and things like that. But really, it's not a huge concern. We do get a lot of like fern spores popping up, but a lot of them are things that, you know, aren't necessarily bad, or it's like they pop up and you just pluck them. You know, we are constantly grooming and maintaining, and, you know, it's nothing's going to get by us. So it's really, that's not like weeds, like unintended weeds are not really a concern of ours. But yeah, pests are definitely a full-time endeavor to watch out for and make sure that we're staying on top of. So physically removing, you know, pest insects when we see them, prophylactically, and spot treating with beneficials, as I mentioned, is a regular thing for us. Everything from lace wings to predatory mites, cryptolamus. We kind of throw everything, parasitic wasps. We use them all. So it's any kind of strategy we can that's not spraying pesticide, we implement.
You know, earlier you'd mentioned having different approaches towards things. And obviously your approach and my approach and other listeners' approach is going to be different. We're all going to do things that suit our purposes in the best way that we can. And I know you mentioned earlier, like what year did you kind of get into keeping dart frogs? Like seriously, if you could just put a year on it.
So those the first tink I got, I think was like 05. And then I think those Lukes were like 08 ish. And then I'd say I really kind of got back into it, like breeding in like 2012.
All right. So, at the time, 2005, that was kind of like the very beginning of Facebook. And there's still a lot of online forums like Frog Forum and whatnot, Dendroboard and whatnot. Do you think that as the hobby has kind of increased exponentially, there's more people in it, there's much more resources available now for people to figure out how they want to do things. Do you feel like the online aspect of it is like too stringent? Do you feel like there's too many rules on people that might keep people from doing things their own way?
I think it's kind of like goes in waves. It's kind of come full circle. I mean, it's like the topics that people want to get worked up about have really changed. You know, like you went back a few years ago and it was like cohabitation, and like people would be like tearing into you on Dendroboard if you even mentioned the thought of putting like a gecko with a frog. And you know, it's like all these kind of like trends kind of come and go. And now it's like, you know, more people than not probably are keeping mourning geckos, or like, you know, if done right, putting two species of dart frog together in a large enclosure, like it can be done. I know, you know, like once upon a time, that was like the worst possible thing you could say. So I think, you know, it's the hobby comes in waves, and the people who are choosing to be vocal online aren't necessarily the people whose opinions matter most always. You know, it's like the loudest voice generally wins. And what I've noticed is a lot of the people I respect most in this hobby are the ones that are not or very, very minimally active online, which is kind of what I was touching on before, is like if people can get involved in their local groups or societies, or find a network of local froggers to connect with in person, I feel like there's just so many more benefits. I mean, there's a ton of great resources online. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, it's an amazing place. You can go online. You could go order an Institute terrarium from Bill, you know, plug and play, order some plants from Glassbox. You know, you could have your thing set up overnight if you want to and buy frogs and be ready to go. But, you know, going to local hobbyists' frog rooms and seeing their collections firsthand and seeing how they set it up and, you know, starting off slow. You know, one thing I feel like that's been I don't want to call it an issue, but one thing I've noticed in the hobby, and I think it was maybe a product of COVID too, when plant prices went crazy, is that every aspect of this hobby is becoming monetized. I mean, like the idea of somebody like giving away a plant, you know, it seems like everybody has to become a salesman. It's like they're always selling plants, they're selling frogs, they're selling this. It's like when I was coming up, my favorite interactions were going to somebody's house, seeing their collection, being like, oh, I've never seen that frog before. That's amazing. Like, oh, what plant is that? Here, take some scissors and try it yourself. Like, that's the mentality that I fear we're losing. Not because of the internet, just because people are only on the internet. You know what I mean? So it's this this kind of like camaraderie that's in this hobby that I really have benefited a ton from that I fear is going away. So I don't know. I think there's just this like giving back aspect that maybe is lost when people are, you know, not interacting in person enough and not just kind of like getting out there. I mean, being in the Seattle area, we have some of like the pioneers of the hobby, like, you know, frogs that are named after people, like lines, lineages, like Todd Kelly. Like, he is local to me and he is an amazing person and resource, and like getting to meet him and interact with him. It's like, you know, these people are almost like put on a pedestal, but then you go interact with them and they're just, you know, they just love the same things you love, you know, and just getting those connections and meeting these people is just, it's kind of what makes the hobby more than a hobby for me. And has led to some like absolutely incredible relationships. So I encourage people to get involved in their local groups and gatherings and get out there and check out other people's things and think about being generous and, you know, giving somebody some tadpoles or some cuttings who's starting out. Cause I think that can go a long way to kind of like, you know, paying it forward and bringing this hobby, you know, keeping it together, I guess, and not just turning it all into like everybody has to have a business.
No, I agree with that. And, you know, like one of the things I mention this every week, so it really, I shouldn't keep coming off like I'm surprised every time I say this, but a lot of this show is about community and it's about talking to people and it's about sharing experiences. And the fact that, I mean, like you mentioned, you get to meet people who you looked up to and kind of idolized as being, you know, on this other level. And it's the same thing with me. Like, I talk to people now, I'm talking to people all the time. Like, wait a minute, like 4 years ago, I was like, I never in my life, never in my wildest dreams had ever thought I'd be actually talking to this guy. And now I am. So I agree with you. I think that the camaraderie and the community, I mean, when you compare it to other communities, like, you know, like reptiles and, I mean, God, man, snake people are like out of their minds. But I feel like, by and large, the poison frog community, I feel like it's pretty civil. I mean, people get a little rough around certain things, but at the end of the day, I feel like if you put 1,000 people on a desert island alone, and it's just you and one other frog person, odds are you're going to be hanging out with that other frog person.
Absolutely. And yeah, I've, like I said, I've been doing this for what, almost 20 years now on and off. And the number of bad apples I've met compared to like people who I really connect with and, you know, and friends with on a deeper level than just the frogs is, you know, far outnumbered. There's really only, I can count on one hand the number of people who have like really, I feel like, you know, done me wrong kind of thing. Whereas like, the number of like actual friendships and people like I would check in on regardless if they keep frogs anymore is extremely high.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's just like-minded individuals.
Absolutely.
Because I feel like with this hobby, there's a significant kind of a, like a nurturing need to it, because when you think about, all right, let's pick something that's not even animal related. Like let's talk about cars. Let's just say that you like classic cars, you like to walk, you know, you like to build classic cars. All right, you know, you can take the car, you can cover it up in your garage and leave it there for a year and completely ignore it, you know? Whereas with animals and plants, it's a commitment. You can't just walk away. And I feel like that dedication, that mindset is sort of intrinsic to all people. And that kind of gives us a common value system, because if you're going to go into this thinking that you can just get a whole bunch of frogs, breed them fast, make a lot of money, it's not the easiest thing to do. Whereas you could potentially buy a lot of classic cars and then flip them without having to worry about feeding them or giving them light or anything like that. So, I mean, to me, at least that was kind of the one commonality. It was people kind of a little retentive, I guess, and obsessive, which I value. And I again, like everybody I've never met anybody on the show who was not like some, like, you know, like a plant look bad. Like even people who were like really like casual about it. And like, how's that plant? Like, I don't know. I didn't like the way it looked. And it's like, I knew it. I knew you felt that way, even though you covered it up. So it's an interesting community for sure. What are you keeping at home? Frog wise and plant wise.
So yeah. So I have, gone through many iterations. It's kind of funny. You know, we actually moved into a new house a couple years ago. And for the first time in my life, I have a frog room. Always the frogs are in my living space. And it turns out I like that better, because I feel like the frog room is somewhere like I have to go, that's like away. Now that I have kids, you know, it's like I have to like bring them in there with me. Whereas like when it was in like the room where my TV was, like I could just turn around and look at them, like get distracted from watching Netflix and, you know, watch the frogs. So it's actually kind of a interesting thing for me that I wasn't expecting. But I do have sort of a frog room man cave office now. And I actually only have, I'm down to 5 tanks. I downsized a bit after our second child was born, just to kind of make room for furniture moving that needed to happen in the house. And I have basically just 5 tanks of large Ufaga now. My collection has, you know, like many, started out with Dendrobates and went to Ranitamea, you know, Pamilio over the years, as I mentioned, Amiriga. I had some Atelopus from Nick Stacy at one point, various micro geckos. But I think when it comes down to it, like, I really, you know, as somebody who works as with vivariums and aquariums all day long, like, I don't want to be coming home and feeling like I'm doing more work, if that makes sense. So the idea of raising tadpoles, which I always did as an optional thing anyway, like I'm happy to let nature take place in the tank and not, you know, interfere. But keeping Ufaga that do kind of do the whole process for themselves is very appealing for me at this point. So I have at this moment Blue Histrionica, Bahia Solano or Solanensis, whatever you want to call them. I have Pacarita, which are like a site-specific locale of Tado. And I have Atrato Histrionica, which are kind of like the creamy yellowy ones. And then I have small form redheads. And I actually just picked up a Pata Blanca Sylvatica. It's my first Sylvatica ever, so I'm pretty excited about that. So yeah, it's a pretty small collection now, but I'm proud to say that all of the breeders, all the 5 tanks of breeding of pairs I have have all officially now become proven. I've all had babies. So it was a long time in the works, but I have babies from all 5 of the Histrionica type morphs I have.
Which type of tanks do you have? Custom built, in situ, like who makes your tanks and how did you do the builds?
Yeah, it's kind of been a progression over time. I started, like many did, with like aquariums that were converted, and top opening vivariums is probably like the first thing I'd recommend not to do for anybody starting out. So yeah, front opening is great. I went through the ExoTerra phase like many do. And then Bill Rodman of Insitu lives like an hour from me, so his shop is super close, and I've been kind of friends with him for a while. So I do have 4 in situ Amazonia tanks from him set up, and they're pretty simple. And then my 5th tank is a custom from a business that was out of Seattle area that's no longer around, but that's like an all glass tank. But yeah, I do like I mess around with different kind of backgrounds. I think 2 of the in situs have like a pressed cork bark background, and 2 of them have like the feather rock kind of mosaic with like sphagnum moss jammed between them. But I've, you know, I've experimented with cork and great stuff and, you know, all the, you know, back in the day, tree fern fiber and tree fern panels, which are amazing for growing plants, but also amazingly horrible for the environment because they're not sustainable. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not a person at this point who spends a ton of time on backgrounds and hardscape. I generally do something pretty two-dimensional on the back, and then, you know, include some piece of like manzanita driftwood type manzanita or ghostwood, I should say. And then, you know, since I am keeping obligates, I do provide bromeliads, and then just an array of, you know, bryophytes. I like the small liverworts a lot. Different aeroids, like varicosum type things, and like the small micro philodendrons I'm kind of a fan of. Triolinas, I generally try to keep it South American. I'm not a biotope person because I'm not that anal about it, but occasionally I'll have like a sonorilla or something that I can't pass up. But generally speaking, I do keep it mostly South American, Central and South American.
You know, a lot of people, myself included, don't work in a gigantic sphere filled with awesome plants. So I have to kind of live vicariously through you, through my, you know, through my collection at home. I mean, is there something like when you have this big overwhelming space that you work in and you're working with plants and water, whatnot all day, like when you come home, does that simplistic approach, is that you find it more relaxed? Cause like when I come home, it's like, I need something to do, you know, I need something kind of complicated to occupy myself. Does having, you know, like a lesson number, let's just say like a more streamlined approach, like, does that help? Like, how does that like work out for you? Like, does it like more relax then? Like, cause I mean, like I can imagine like having a job like that's, you know, a lot of responsibilities and you come home, you might want to unwind. Is that a factor at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the job and also like having two young kids, streamlining is extremely important. You know, I also, you know, ferry commute to work. So I, you know, I don't have the shortest commute in the world. So the amount of time I have at home between, you know, having to go to bed and doing it all over again for work the next day is limited. So having, you know, I can feed my frog room, like including the tubs with babies and stuff, in like less than 4 minutes, I think. So I make two fruit fly cultures a week. I make one melanogaster and one Heidii, and that's it. You know, even when I was at peak collection, which was like 10 or so tanks, I think, I never had like a massive, you know, 60 tank setup. I always tried to keep it reasonable because I never wanted it to feel like a job. I do want this to be a hobby and something I truly enjoy. So I think at my max, I was making 3 or 4 cultures a week. I don't understand how anybody could make 30 cultures a week. That sounds like my personal hell, to be honest with you. So yeah, keeping it streamlined, keeping it manageable. You know, I keep like a few shoe boxes full of springtails as kind of master cultures. I'm regimented about the fruit flies. I do make sure that's like a weekly thing, so I never run out. And I've never had a culture crash ever. So I've never had to like, you know, beg, borrow, and steal, like looking for, you know, somebody producing flies. Like I just keep that going. And yeah, I just want it to be something like, you know, when I have a minute here or there, just like sneak away and go like, check out like, oh my gosh, I have Bahia Solano breeding in my house. Those are like, those things glow, you know, you can see them from across the room. I remember the first time I saw those in a private collection, I was just like, yeah, that's the frog. So, you know, still feeling that wonder, you know, still like getting excited every time you find a baby, you know, watching them grow, watching their patterns change, like that's still fun to me. Whereas like, you know, I work with aquariums mostly at my role at the spheres, so a lot of planted tanks, you know, CO2 injected aquariums fully planted with tropical fish, and people are like, oh, what kind of fish do you have at home? I'm like, yeah, I don't need to do any more water changes. I do water changes for a living. Like, I don't need to do that at home. So I get a lot of my kicks out at work and then, you know, really get to focus on like my prized frogs at home, if you will. And, you know, as little work as possible means I just get to enjoy the frogs more in the limited time I do have.
I can relate to that. Yeah, when you're doing something professionally, you kind of want to leave it at work, even if it's something that you're partially interested in. Like all this,
I'm very interested in it, but at the same time, it's like, you know, we have some wild type discus. Like, I do not want to maintain a discus tank at home. Like, that sounds like expensive, messy, a good way to ruin your floors, a good way to like ruin a vacation when you come home to a bunch of, you know, dead fish. Like, it's really nice being able to kind of separate those things. And I, you know, when somebody else is paying the budget for these, you know, like your fish order too, it makes it a lot nicer. So yeah, I do fantasize about reef tanks still, like on the regular, so maybe one day I'll get back into that. But I'm also pretty impressed with people's the trend towards like macroalgae tanks, so I could see doing that also.
Yeah, I'm streamlining myself. I mean I'm at a point in my life now where I don't have any interest in getting anything new, and I'm kind of downsizing what I have and just, my goal is to just improve the tanks that I kind of want to, there's a lot of stuff I want to scrap and start over. So I kind of want to provide what I have larger, more elaborate enclosures and not, you know, add any more to that. Cause like you said, it's, you come home and it's still work. I mean, I'm making 8 cultures, 9 cultures a week, which isn't a huge deal by anyone's, you know, by anyone's standards, but I don't know. I especially like with the Tinctorius, I mean, I can't keep my tinks in groups because somehow I ended up with this army of female tinks and I got to keep every one of them separate. I had stuff that was supposed to be a pair and whatnot. And now it's like, I've got all these solo tanks of female tanks and I got to take, you know, I still got to take care of them. Whereas with like, you know, Phylobates, you know, you can keep a group of Phylobates together and they're not going to have a Hunger Games brawl. So I don't know. I'm on the same page. I'm trying to streamline my approach because I don't want to be, you know, you want to come home, you want to enjoy it. You don't want it to own you. And I think that like a lot of younger people who are going into the hobby, I mean, any animal hobby and getting, you know, 20 tanks set up in the first year or whatnot. And you got to ask yourself in 5 years, 10 years, the frog is still going to be around. Where are you going to be?
Yeah, exactly.
And especially, you know, having kids is that changes the dynamic as well. Cause your kids grow up, you know, frog's going to look exactly the same, but you know, you're dealing with kids and family and stuff, you know, life changes. So like anybody who's just starting out, like, yeah, enjoy it, but just kind of have some perspective in terms of where you think you're going to be in 5 years, 10 years, and try to plan your collection accordingly.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And, you know, it's natural for people to get excited and, you know, want to catch them all kind of thing, but it's, yeah, there's a lot to be said about kind of going slow and steady and making sure you can manage the upkeep. And, you know, it's just too common where you see like collection for sale and, you know, racks of tanks people are trying to like sell. It's like, you know, some of it you can kind of see, you know, when you're in the hobby long enough, you see it coming, you know, like the people who come in so strong, you're like, is that guy gonna last? I hope so. But, you know, it's, unfortunately it's not something that is sustainable on a large scale for a lot of people.
No. I mean, especially with things like plants and whatnot. I mean, that's the thing, is like you got a tank that's heavily planted. You can't just ignore it. I mean, if you've got, you know, an arid species of lizard or something like that, you know, you're not necessarily watering plants. It might be able to go, you know, week, 2 weeks, whatever, without a tremendous amount of attention. But I mean, dude, like I, you know, if I get a day in the summer where my air conditioner breaks down, it's game over for the frogs. I'm sorry, but you get a couple of like 90 degree days, you're done for. So you're kind of married to that. But, you know, I feel like other animals are a little bit more tolerant of, you know, less than ideal parameters, but the frogs just don't put up with that.
Yeah, I do. I would say I recommend anybody who's serious about it and has any collection of value and size, like invest in a misting system, invest in a generator if you can, and, you know, like portable heating and air conditioning, because there's just too many heartbreaking stories you hear about failures. So I do run off a Mist King system, and our house has a backup generator. In our old house, I remember literally having to like wheel my racks to like the one room that had like a gas fireplace when the power went out. So yeah, if you could avoid situations like that, it's it'll feel a lot better, and then you'll be able to travel. And you know, I mean, I feel confident leaving my frogs like with a little bit of preparation and like making some mini cultures to put in the tanks and bananas and stuff for like 2 weeks. No problem at all.
Yeah, the racks on wheels, that's another thing that Lynn from Fern Frog, she was telling me that. I think she's got her racks on wheels so she can pull them out and service behind them. Like, I think that's a good idea. I got to do that when I upgrade
game changer. Room. Yeah, 100% game changer.
What advice would you give someone who wants to start out? Someone who says, all right, you know, I want to get into frogs. I'm excited. I've seen this on YouTube. I've seen this on the forums. You know, how do I get started? What advice would you give to a beginner?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the thing. It's there are so many great channels now. A lot of your previous guests, you know, have really great tutorials. Like, I love the DIY aspect of this hobby. You know, a lot of it you can just plug and play now, which is a great option too. But there's something to be said about like building something with your bare hands from scratch and cutting glass and drilling glass and siliconing and, you know, carving great stuff. Like, that kind of part of it, I think, is important. So I would say, you know, watch those videos, you know, check out different techniques, see what's going to be, you know, feasible for your skill set and the tools you have at home. Cause, you know, that first one is probably always going to be the most expensive one, as you're kind of needing to, you know, buy a lot of the things that you could then reuse for your subsequent builds and the tools and things like that. Yeah. And just go slow, you know, build a tank, let it mature, let that vinegar silicone smell go away before, you know, adding the plants, and then let the plants mature, let them root, throw some bugs in there, you know, try to get some springtails going, maybe some isopods if you're feeling crazy. You know, it doesn't have to be this, like, I think some just want it to happen overnight. You know, it's like, again, nature takes time, and it's not like an aquarium where there's like a set cycling time where you can like, okay, I measured the nitrates and the ammonium and now we're good. It's like, you know, some of these things, it's just like, just let it settle, you know, let the tank kind of, you know, start growing at least. And, you know, feel like, you know, like the, even if you're not using any like gauges, just like, see how the condensation on the glass changes from day to day. Like, get your watering schedule figured out. Figure out how to culture fruit flies. It's not hard, but it is something that you have to, you know, get the moisture content right in your flies. And like, depending on where you are in the country, that can be a factor that determines success. So really, yeah, just, you know, watching those videos, getting the techniques, getting your hands dirty, and not being afraid to try things. I think there's also this, you know, with the tropical plant boom, this like tendency to want to buy all these like fancy, you know, high dollar plants. Like, you can go to Home Depot and you can buy that, you know, pot of pothos, and that's fine. Or you can buy some, you know, beginner plants. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. They'll grow well, and then it'll teach you how to grow plants. You know, and then as over time, you could swap them out for something that, you know, is more interesting to you, and something that, you know, maybe has slightly more demanding care requirements. So that would be my recommendation, is just kind of go into it, kind of, you know, take what you can from, you know, watching videos, but ultimately just go for it, but take your time. There's no rush. You know, the frogs aren't going anywhere. Even, you know, in the Midwest, in the middle of winter, you can still get frog shipped to you if you find a shipping window. So, you know, there's no rush. The frogs are available. You know, the world is so open to, you know, shipping now that it's, you can kind of get anything anytime, or at least within driving distance too, for most places. So that would be my recommendation.
Yeah, I think that, like, if you wanted to put like a basic entrance exam for frogs, like, you have to prove that you can keep pothos alive. Cause if you kill pothos, you'll kill everything.
Yep. And honestly, like, there's like, you know, I have people reach out to me, like, you know, I'm not super active on social media, but like, I had kid reach out to me on Instagram. He was like super excited to start his first frog tank. Like, I sent him a bag of cuttings. I'm not saying that as like a, you know, like, oh, I'm the best guy out there, I'm so generous. It's just like, you know, like, people who are excited, like, I want to be able to, you know, tap into that excitement too. And just being able to, like, you know, when I cut my terrariums, like, I throw those plants away, because like, it's not worth it to me to like put up plant packages. And so it's like, if you can do that, or find somebody local who's, you know, has a tank to trim, like, it's, you know, share the wealth a little bit, and that'll give people an opportunity to try that, you know, that varicosum or whatever, you know, plant that, you know, is really cool for the first time when you get it, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm not like very deep into the plant world. I mean, what I have is not, again, I don't have anything that's that out of control, but it's interesting how that whole phenomenon in and of itself became this big like boom and bust where people were spending like $600 on cuttings. And you know, I don't know if everybody was having success with those cuttings. I might be pretty pissed off if I bought a $600 cutting and I killed it.
Crazy.
Like, do you have any thoughts on like the plant community, or not only community, but like the plant industry, I guess we could call it. I mean, cause I mean, technically, you know, you work in a building that's, you know, professionally maintained plants. Is there a market that affects that as well? Like, I mean, is pricing a factor when you're buying plants, and is there seasonal availability, and you know, like, do you get, like, can hobbyists get them from the same place that you guys get for your backups?
That's a good question. Yeah. You know, we do, since we are kind of a larger scale, we do get wholesale from a lot of places, and a lot of the, like, the local wholesalers of tropical plants for Seattle are the ones that supply all like the local plant stores. So yeah, you would have to be like a commercial grower to be able to purchase directly from them. But in terms of like accessibility, it's all the same stuff. The tropical plant hobby, I think, has responded really well to changes in the market. So obviously, or maybe not so obviously to everybody, during COVID, plant prices got absolutely insane. And there was a huge demand for aroids in particular, that just, you know, like Monstera obliqua was like a plant that was going for hundreds of dollars. And it's like, it doesn't look that different than Monstera adansonii, in my opinion. It's, you know, it's like Swiss cheese plant. It's, you know, so all these things that just had this niche market that was just blowing up. But, you know, the big businesses saw that and they started producing these things in large numbers. You got companies like Equigenera and Equiflora out of Ecuador that are producing, you know, stunning plants. They keep opening more nurseries throughout the U.S., making a lot of their plants accessible. And they vend like almost all of the like bigger tropical plant shows across the country. So that's a really good source for people to get kind of interesting South American species. But yeah, I mean, even the like the growth in like tissue culture plants, like all these really cool like begonias and stuff that were used to be really hard to find as like one-offs are now being produced en masse via tissue culture. So there's a lot of options out there now. A lot of really cool, for the non-purists, there's a lot of really cool crosses and hybrids coming out that are pretty neat. So yeah, I mean, the tropical plant hobby exploded, and now I think the commercial market is exploding with it, and the prices are kind of falling in line with a more, viable price tag for a lot of consumers to be able to afford. So, you know, for there is a difference, though, I think, between like a tropical plant hobbyist and a dart frog hobbyist. Like, there's overlap in the things that people want, but, you know, getting buying a node off of like Etsy for like some rare, you know, Thai constellation Monstera, like, it's probably not the move that most frog keepers would go. They would probably, you know, get a cutting from one of their frog friends for, you know, a fraction of the price, and I hope, or for free. Like, that's kind of the hope I still have in the hobby, and the belief I have that there is still enough of a community out there where people can like get a starter plant package for their, you know, 24-inch tank and fill it up for not too much money. Because like the idea of having to go to like your local plant shop, like targeted towards tropical plant specific hobbyists, is not really affordable for most people. So and we, you know, as I mentioned, have a whole team of greenhouse staff that propagate for us from material we have on hand. So we do purchase from wholesalers occasionally, but we also are constantly growing plants from ones we have in our collection, from seed, from cuttings, from leaf cuttings, stem cuttings, nodes, we do it all. So that's another long-winded answer.
Are there any plans to introduce any kind of animals other than fish into the spheres?
I would say stay tuned. Yeah. We do have two dart frog terrariums in a neighboring building. They were these really neat custom terrariums built by Variance Design. That's the same company that Chelsea Thomas mentioned for the new displays at Atlanta Botanical Garden. We work with Variance a ton for creating these like really stunning museum quality terrariums and like living wall displays. So we do have dart frogs on display. We have some Terribilis and some Pimelio that are extremely well received. So the idea for frogs to one day appear in the spheres, I would say, is very much not out of the question, but I will remain coy with my answer. How about that?
No comments, no comments. Understood.
Yeah.
That was going to be my next question, was how do people... I mean, if you were to see people out on the streets of Seattle just going about their normal routines as opposed to people inside the spheres, do you notice anything different about the way people perceive the space?
We still get a ton. Unfortunately, you know, it's not really a building that's like has signage associated with it. So we do still, and because it's sort of like very unique amongst the landscape of like office buildings and towers and low and high rises all around it. So it's like you have this building that's three glass balls in the middle of the city, and you kind of wonder, like, what is that? So we still on the daily get, you know, probably dozens of tourists and just passerbys walk in and say, like, what is this place? So, yeah, we definitely still get a lot of that. We get a lot of people taking selfies outside the building. We get a lot of people taking pictures of the building, a lot of people wanting to know what, you know, what's going on in there, like, and then also people just standing in awe and looking at the plants through the glass and just, you know, wanting to come back. And many do get to come back. Again, we do have those public days twice a month. So it's a great opportunity for anybody who's in the Seattle area and wants to come visit. I highly recommend it because it really is high level horticulture, kind of like a mini botanic garden, if you will, in a very unique setting. With cool fish tanks, polydarium, terrariums too, and good coffee. So we got it all.
Yeah, the nearest thing I could think of was the National Aquarium in Baltimore, where is that like terrarium / walk through rainforest.
Amazon exhibit, yeah, or something like that.
I mean, I haven't been there in probably 25 years, but it's like a big pyramid on top of the aquarium, and it's just so it's visual from the Inner Harbor, so you can, you know, it's kind of a landmark, I guess, the same way this would be.
Yeah, we have staff who have associations with that building, and I know their curator is friends with our old managers and bosses as well too, so we're connected to them in some ways. And yeah, like Cal Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, they have their Osher Rainforest exhibit, which is kind of like a single sphere inside their building too, that's similar. The one thing I will say is that makes us unique is that, yeah, our space is not hot and muggy and fully tropical like one of those. We are still comfortable for people, which is unique and makes it nice to be able to work in all day. You're not sweating.
Yeah, the controls must be pretty sophisticated to be able to pull that off. Well, Rob, we're kind of at the end here, but, I wanted to just give you a chance to maybe run down anything that, if anybody's interested in learning more about what you do or what goes on at the spheres, or if anybody's interested in, you know, kind of getting deeper into that kind of a topic or kind of into that universe, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I encourage people to check out seattlespheres.com. It's not really the most up-to-date website, but it is the gateway for anybody who wants to make a reservation to come check out the space. We do also have a couple Instagram accounts associated with the space. There's @SeattleSpheres and @Plants of Amazon, which will give you a sense of where we are. And then anybody's welcome to check out my personal account. I don't post a ton of pictures of my frogs or of the spheres, but I do try to occasionally. And that's my personal account is _frogfish_. I think I know a lot of the old school people in this hobby, but it's always fun to get to meet new people too. So anybody who's interested in, you know, planted aquariums and tropical frogs is probably my kind of person. So yeah, feel free to reach out.
Oh, it's definitely the job of a lifetime. I mean, it's so cool. You get to work in a place like that.
Yeah, I thank my lucky stars every day. It's pretty awesome. It's I don't know how I lucked my way in, but I'm not planning on going anywhere.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Again, I want to thank Rob for coming on and talking to us about this. This is an amazing place. And I mean, I'm looking at pictures of it online. And again, if any of you are interested in, I mean, obviously, like Rob mentioned, it's not really a public place. But yeah, hit up Rob if you want some more information. And, you know, if you can't get there personally, check out some of the photos online, because it's pretty cool. I mean, the living wall, the lighting, everything is just amazing. So yeah, pretty cool stuff. All right, everyone. Hope you guys enjoyed this one. I know I did. I've got some pretty cool stuff coming up, so make sure you stay tuned, and I will catch up with you all again next time.